Tonight on Arena, Alana Hopkins shares the good and the bad of a three-decade relationship in the memoir A Very Strange Man, and we review new albums from Soda Blonde, The Wallflowers and Inhaler. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Arena, at RTE Arena. In A Very Strange Man, writer Alana Hopkin recounts her 29-year relationship with the novelist Aidan Higgins. From the thunderbolt of first love to the difficulties of Aidan's diagnosis with dementia, the memoir charts their life together in Kinsale from 1986 through until 2015. 23 years, Alana senior. Aidan produced mainly fiction and memoirs during this time, while Alana prioritised work that would pay the bills. And delighted to have Alana Hopkin join us from Kinsale this evening. The subtitle to the book, Alana, A Very Strange Man, A Memoir of Aidan Higgins. Now, to write about someone who has been so important to you personally and emotionally cannot have been an easy task. Was it a difficult decision to take on this book in the first place?
Well, it had been on my mind for the last year of Aidan's life. I thought it would be a good thing to memorialise him somehow. And so I was kind of having little stabs at it here and there and seeing if I could find a voice, if I could get it going. And it built up from there, and it turned out to be possible. At first, I thought it probably wouldn't work. Nice idea, but. But the more I kept at it, the more it came good.
Yeah, because you had to do some very difficult things, not least of which was, and I know you say that never would you have dreamt of reading Aidan's diaries while he was alive and sitting in front of you, and he was writing to them in the privacy of his own study or his own room or wherever he was doing it. But you did, you had to go right in there and look at those very personal thoughts that he would put down on the page, not necessarily for others to look at.
Yes, absolutely. And I was really, you know, very meticulous about not reading his notebooks that I found lying around, and I hoped he wasn't reading mine either. In fact, he did sometimes, but it was kind of a risk because I didn't know what I was going to find. On the other hand, I did know he was a good man and he loved me. I was pretty sure of that. So I didn't think I'd find anything too terrible. And actually, I found some very nice things that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah,
but it took a bit of a leap.
I'd say, even just to do that, you know, with the letters of somebody or the notes of somebody after they've died is a very difficult thing. But the most gratifying thing, or one of the most gratifying things, must have been the entry that you saw around, or for the very night that you met, in fact. And I think the entry was made possibly a day or two, the following day or a day or two later.
Right, yes.
So explain how you met, first of all, in the opening section of the book, which you call Thunderbolt.
yes.
So explain how you met and what the thunderbolt was that hit you, and then we can hear about the diary entry subsequently.
Right. Well, it was Derek Mann was the friend of mine in London, and I didn't realise he lived in Kinsale on and off. And as it happened, he moved here roughly the same time I did, around 1982, for a prolonged stay. So we were kind of pals, and you'd run into each other around town. And he asked me to help him entertain his friend Higgins, which is what he called Aidan. And there were various delays and postponements to the arrival of Higgins. Then finally, here he was, and we met in the bar of Acton's Hotel after I'd been for my swim, and I still had wet hair. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be funny if Aidan turned out to be someone important in my life and his first glance of me is of someone with an otter-like wet head? But it went well. I just liked him. I'd heard his voice on the phone before and liked that, and I liked him even more in person.
Was it a true thunderbolt moment? I mean, as you describe it in the book, and as when we'll get to Aidan's description afterwards, it does sound as if it was, you know, Cupid shot the arrow. And
it really was. He The first time we kissed, he managed to break his glasses and they fell off. And that was when I looked into his eyes and they were exactly the same color hazel as mine. And it was like looking into my own soul. It really was a sort of heavyweight romantic moment, even though I'm not normally that way inclined. And I sort of knew then this is going to be a really big one and it's going to last.
Yeah. And then no, you didn't get to see his. You had to gauge his reaction somehow. And then, you know, the fact that you were together for 29 years after that must mean that his reaction was pretty good. But when you read, tell us what he wrote about you then. You mentioned the otter looking like a wet otter. He mentions that in his diary entry as well. But he kind of had a sense in his diary entry after meeting you that this was important to him. This was an important person he just met too, hadn't he?
Yes, very much so. It was rather extraordinary. Here it is. She had, yeah, the hair at the nape of her neck was damp. I thought she had something of the otter in her. She had the delicateness of a cat, something quiet and feline. The voice pitched low, no discernible Irish accents, certainly not Cork. Skin. Drinking red wine, and so on. Yes, yeah. He liked what he saw too.
Yeah, no, it was. It's a very beautiful way that he expresses just that beginning of a relationship, and as I said, that must have been the huge relief thing. Well, okay, maybe I can continue on with these notes and these diaries now. I'm not going to see things too badly. However, you know,
it's.
I said in my introduction, I said at the beginning of the program tonight, you're not afraid to tell us the good and the bad here, and I thought it was quite brave of you and quite courageous, you know, to go ahead and say, look, yeah, we loved each other, but we had times when we wanted to kill each other, possibly.
Yes.
Not least of which was, I think it was a reaction he had. He was reading a book of yours. Have I got this right now? He was reading a book of yours, and in that book, a character throws a book of Aidan Higgins's to the one side. He did not take too well to that.
No. He had a very ambiguous view of my fiction. It wasn't to his taste at all, and he wasn't afraid to say so. But, you know, you can get over that. It was a disappointment. But then I didn't like some of his fiction either. So it was mutual. But we somehow managed to survive this disagreement.
Yeah,
but, you know, you were saying earlier that it was brave or whatever. Actually, once I started writing and it started to go, I realized I'm going to have to tell everything or it's not going to work. You can't write a book like this and not be totally honest, whether you like it or not. So I ended up giving away a lot more about myself than I thought I would have to. And to the point where my friends and family find it quite difficult to read at times.
Yeah, because I did wonder about that subtitle, A Memoir of Aidan Higgins. You know, you could add underneath that, and you'll find out a lot about Alana Hopkin in the process as well, because we do.
Absolutely. Maybe we should have had a second subtitle.
we do find out a lot about you, not least of which, and I just wondered, you know, how you process this in hindsight. You talk about, I mean, at the time, life as a writer is never going to be, unless you're incredibly lucky and you happen to hit one of those blockbusters that makes you lots and lots of money and therefore you can live off the proceeds from it for the rest of your life. But, you know, yourself and Aidan were writing worthwhile material but not necessarily making huge amounts of money from it, let's be honest. And you made lots of decisions which were very much of the practical nature. You know, well, I'll do this because I have to make some money to pay the rent, to put food on the table and to pay the bills. Did you ever resent that, you know, because it seemed to me as if you were supporting, you never would have asked Aidan, look, would you do that just for the money? I know you don't want to, but I don't want to do these other...
Oh, no, absolutely not, because the whole principle, we weren't married for the first 11 years and we kept very independent financial matters. Like I had my own bank account and he had his and we somehow divvied up the expenses and there was never any argument about anything, but he had his canoes, you know, the Estona payment, and that covered his part of the mortgage and the household expenses, and whatever was left over he could have fun with. But I had to earn my full own living, which meant I had to do some things that I'd probably rather not have done. And I had to postpone spending prolonged time on my own writing every now and then, but I never resented it. I think it's good for a writer to have the need to make money from your writing every now and then, because it's a discipline. Yeah. And it can be quite fun as well. You do all sorts of things you'd never have done if you were a full-time sitting at home reading books and writing kind of writer.
Aidan had a relationship by correspondence with Beckett. How regular was the correspondence? How close was that relationship, albeit by letter for the most part, is my understanding?
Well, Beckett was very helpful to Aidan when he was starting out, before he'd even published anything. And he sent him some wonderful letters, not that many, about 20 or 30. And one of the pieces of advice was, despair young and never look back. And I think it was a huge help to Aidan, knowing he had this writer whose work he admired so much, taking such an interest in his early efforts. But round about the late 60s, early 70s, it kind of cooled off, and they didn't write to each other that much anymore.
Aidan is often he's often placed as a kind of a link, if you like, between the Joyce and the Beckett and that sort of early modernism and late modernism, if you like. That Aidan is a
The Flann O'Brien.
Yeah, he's a link between that and what came to us then, I suppose, later in the 70s. Would you define his work, Aidan Higgins's work, in that way?
Yes, it is a kind of link. And he looked very much to Europe and America. And he lived outside Ireland from the age of 18 or so until 40-something, because there was no way he could live in Ireland and write. So I think, yes, the Flann O'Brien connection is a very important sort of other link between it's Joyce, Beckett, Flann O'Brien, and Aidan would be somewhere between Flann O'Brien and whoever's coming next.
Yeah. Is it the anarchy of Flann O'Brien that you see as important there, Alana, or the humour of Flann O'Brien?
Very much so, yeah. The anarchy and the humour. Aidan's writing is often quite funny, which is not a very well-known fact, but thanks to Neil Donnelly, who has made little theatre pieces of some of Aidan's writing, and he calls it Higgins the Jester. And it really brings out the comic in his work. And that's where I think he connects most strongly to Flann O'Brien.
You bring us through in the memoir then, you bring us through that thunderbolt in 1986, through the very long honeymoon with a few ups and downs along the way and a couple of big rows that you had to get past. But then there's a kind of a sadness that starts to seep into the book in 1990, as you get into 1999 and the beginning of the new millennium. Deterioration has started at this point. What were the first signs of that in Aidan's physical well-being, that there was something not quite right?
It was when we were in Spain in Nerja one Christmas. It's a very small village. He knows it very well, and he kept getting lost. And that's often a sure sign that there is some kind of dementia starting. And forgetting names, like forgetting Derek's name.
Derek Mahan, yeah.
Derek Mahan, looking at him, what's his name? And then forgetting the title of his novel, Bornholm Night Fairy. It was kind of like there were big Swiss cheese holes in his brain, and it was a form of mental decline that could be measured by a scan. And when they saw it, they were just amazed that the doctors were amazed that he was walking around and apparently normal. But it was the beginning of the dementia getting a hold.
Yeah, and as it became, the eventual diagnosis was vascular dementia, and that was going one direction only. Can I just check, we're not sure whether it's the actual line itself, or are there any papers or anything around the desk where you're speaking there, Alana? Just if there are, could you keep them still? Because they're interfering slightly. I don't know, it may be the line, but we'll keep going and hopefully it...
No, I'm afraid I was holding onto the laptop.
Well, there you go. Let go of that
laptop. Is it better now?
It's much better
Great.
Now, yes. That's good.
Okay.
This is... This, this for me was the section of the memoir that I'm guessing, you know, from that diagnosis of vascular dementia for Aidan, this must have been the section that was hardest to write, the section that was obviously closest in time. The thunderbolt of first love has gone at this age, but there's a much deeper, there's a very deep love. Let's not make comparisons. A very deep love, certainly present at this point. And moving, Aidan's having to move into a nursing home was a really difficult moment and time for both of you, I think.
Oh, it was, yes. Obviously more so for him. But I wasn't quite aware how difficult it would be for me, because I was by then so used to looking after him. And suddenly there was this big blank in my life. No Aidan at home anymore. No Aidan to worry about and so on. But I got used to it. And we were very lucky in the nursing home in that they were very kind and very flexible. And they made a big pet of him. And, you know, it was as nice as it could be. But you're leaving go of so much, you know, like they chose what clothes he was going to wear and what food he was going to eat. And that used to be my job. Yeah. So it's a big adjustment for both of you.
And you very much had two Aidens at this point as well to contend with in some ways.
In that
you had the Aidan who would get lost in the dementia and be quite difficult and cantankerous, and there was real Aidan who would seep out that tenderness that would seep out every so often.
Yes, yes, he retained great affection for me, and he was able to show it in touch, you know, holding hands and rubbing foreheads, that kind of thing, as he got worse and worse. So there was always a connection, and that interested me because I had no idea what it was like to be as disabled as he was by a mental condition, and to be looked after by other people. And I found that it was not as terrifying and horrible as I thought it would be. It was actually quite beautiful in its way, because you had all this kindness of other people directed towards him. And it was sort of inspiring. So I wanted to make a record of that as well.
That is very... that is very clear in the book, the Ballintubber nursing home that you speak about. You speak about it with such care, in fact, and you're so praising of the care that was given to Aidan. It's very noticeable, yeah. I must say.
And what I learned was that there are some people who have a remarkable gift for caring. They're really good at it, and that's why they do it. And some of them are quite young.
Yeah.
And I found that very touching.
There is also a lovely moment that you might describe for me as we finish up. I think it was a Polish nurse who was with you. You had been away, but thankfully you got back on time to be at Aidan's bedside as he passed away. And there was a Polish...
Yes.
You did something and the Polish nurse remarked on it. Maybe you'd tell us what happened.
I just automatically, as soon as I knew he'd gone and I was alone in the room, I got up and I opened the window. It was night and dark, and the Polish nurse Gosia came in and she just said, "I'm glad you opened the window. We do that too." And I thought that was lovely.
And had this, you that sense of... This sense of releasing the spirit, is that why you were opening the window yourself?
It seemed to be needed to be done, if you know what I mean.
Well,
I thought it was a good idea.
Well, it certainly
because
was.
Because he'd gone somewhere, so...
Listen, lovely to have spoken with you, Alana, and thank you so much both for sharing your thoughts with us this evening, and indeed in the memoir itself. Alana Hopkin there speaking to us about A Very Strange Man, a memoir of Aidan Higgins, which is published by New Island Books, and Alana Hopkin will appear at the Kinsale Arts Week on the 10th of July. You can get further details, that's tomorrow night, isn't it? Yes, at kinsaleartsweekend.com. She's also in Bantry on the 11th of July as part of this year's West Cork Literary Festival, and you can get full details on that on westcorkmusic.ie/LF programme. Print Rebels presents an exhibition of 140 historical and contemporary original prints. The exhibition opens a window on the print on printmaking across five centuries and will be a unique opportunity to see the work of printmaking greats at the City Assembly House in Dublin. Works contained in Print Rebels have been collected across the past 2.5 decades by Cork-born and Crawford and Chelsea graduate Edward Tuhig, who's with me in studio this evening. And I suppose to find your route into printmaking in the first place and prints and your interest in them, Edward, we only have to look at the cover of the catalogue for Print Rebels and the reproduction of the print that's inside in the book, Mittenhall from Sir Francis Seymour Hayden. So maybe you describe the image to us first of all and why this is kind of important in your story, if you like.
Absolutely. Well, the first thing I would say is this artist, Seymour Hayden, he makes line come alive. It quivers with intensity. The second thing is his use of light and dark. Beautiful contrasts. And he learned that from studying the works of Rembrandt.
Yeah, so what we're looking at is a doorway off in the distance from a trees all around it. And what exactly is the medium here? Is this a print or is this an etching or is this a drawing?
A bit of everything, really. It's dry point and it's drawn from observation, so straight onto a copper plate. Now, the wonderful thing about Seymour Hayden was he was a surgeon and he drew to steady his hand for incisions into people. And what I find fascinating about Hayden also is the very fact that why I consider him to be a rebel is printmaking during Victorian times is primarily a reproductive purpose proliferate images of famous paintings. Hayden did not like that at all. So what he did, he had pockets stitched into the back of to the sides of his jacket, and he inserted metal plates, copper plates, and anything that inspired him, he'd whip that out, and a couple of very sharp needle to basically scratch into the metal, and he'd work from observation. And that's why, even looking at that Mittenhall created in 1859, it looks fresh today.
And it is. It's that light that you don't. For me anyway, I don't normally think of light as being an important aspect in printmaking. You think, oh no, that's just going to be like a reproduction of something else, and light won't be that important. Yeah. However, the important thing is the other thing that you told us there is this idea that it scratched directly onto a copper plate, which brings us to a story about you in an hotel in Amsterdam. And this sound, which normally on radio, a producer would be going, what's that sound? It's this sound. Or...
Indeed.
Yes. Indeed. Why were you getting that scratching sound in the hotel, and what happened?
Well, what I was doing, I was actually scratching away on a plate, working from a scene that I saw in Sinner Park actually that day. And what happened was the couple next door complained to the manager. The manager banged on the door. It was about 10 o'clock. And believed that I actually had a pet rat in the room. And I was just showing him, actually, no, I'm drawing on a metal piece, actually.
It does sound like the sound of a rat scratching in an attic, if you've ever heard that sound. It's not a great sound. Maybe a good sound for printmakers. It's not a good sound for people in general. But that brings us to Rembrandt. You were in Amsterdam, connected with Rembrandt. And Rembrandt, I suppose, is the father of printmaking in many ways, isn't he?
Well, he's the king. And Hayden would acknowledge that. What Hayden did, he catalogued his work. He was the first to properly catalogue it in a chronological order. Again, I mean, Hayden was a polymath, a surgeon to Queen Victoria, to Charles Stuart Parnell, to the second and third Duke of Wellington's, and many others. His great friend, Lady Hawarden, who lived in Hawarden, the Hawarden estate in Tipperary, along the River Mutine, Dundrum House, He stayed there four or five times, and he actually built a studio out in the stables.
Yeah, and there's a lovely print in the catalogue as well of the river down there as well.
Sunset, it's gorgeous.
The three printers or artists who are mentioned on the front of the Print Rebels catalogue are Hayden, who we've just spoken about, Palmer and Whistler. Tell me a little bit about Palmer, because Hayden was very much that Victorian era. Where are we with Palmer and Whistler?
Palmer was born in 1805 and died in 1881. He was a great friend of Hayden. Hayden actually printed his work for him as well, and great camaraderie. And Hayden believed that of any printmaker living at the time, to be admitted as a member of the Royal Academy as a printmaker, it should have been Samuel Palmer. What Hayden did is that he set up a rival society to the Royal Academy, and that was in 1880, and it was the Society of Painter Etchers.
And that's where we get RE, because they've got a royal charter.
That's it. So,
and you have on the Print Rebels, the RE is highlighted to kind of emphasise that side of things out. Was Whistler later on then?
Whistler was actually Hayden's brother-in-law. Now, in the 1860s, Hayden and Palmer fell out. Hayden and Whistler fell out. Whistler pushed Hayden through a glass window, first floor in Paris.
Yeah, that would cause
that
a bit
was
of a,
quite nasty.
Yeah, that
quite
might,
nasty.
Might cause a bit, little bit of fallout, okay, of falling out of more than one way for friends. So we're dealing, for the most part, with that Victorian era as being vitally important. But as I flick back towards the back of the book and the back of the catalogue, I get a whole different new set of contemporary prints that are in there. Have the techniques changed hugely over the period that we're talking about? Like I said, 500, that might be a slight exaggeration. A couple of hundred years really, isn't it? Well, three, certainly.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, the actual exhibition, it's over five centuries of printmaking, and that's in Dublin at the moment. And you're quite right. I mean, what's happened with printmaking today, it's like a river, and it's kind of grown out to various different tributaries. So you could say, I mean, digital printing is still, you know, it would be seen as an original form. And it's very much, in my opinion, you know, the voice of the 21st century. Whereas in Victorian times, etching, mezzotint was very, very popular. Lithography in France, but particularly in Britain and in Ireland, etching. And dry point.
Let me finish with one question, which I'm amazed to find to hear that you got a chance to do. It goes back to that time in Amsterdam when you were accused of being having a pet rat in the hotel. You got to print on an original plate made by Rembrandt.
I did.
Now, that must have been extraordinary. And here you were in the 21st century, going back those 300 years or what?
Well, my hands are shaking. First of all, to have a copper plate, hand-beaten, very thick gauge, to look at the lines and see, you know, what this man had created. And also, you know, I found it incredibly modern, because what he had there was rest areas, light areas, you know, sort of areas that were almost not even touched by his hand. And they were contrasted by incredibly dense areas, and that wonderful contrast, which was picked up by Hayden.
Did you get to bring that print home?
I did. It's on very cheap paper, and it's actually in Rebels in the Assembly House.
Oh, well, there you go. People can go searching for that as well. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Edward. That's Edward Tuhig speaking to us about Print Rebels, which is a window on printmaking across five centuries, is correct and right. It's at the Irish Georgian Society, City Assembly House, South William Street, Dublin, until the 27th of August, when you find out full details on IGS, that's Irish Georgian Society, igs.ie, and check out the catalogue as well. A real fountain of information. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up, rising out of the ashes of acclaimed Dublin band Little Green Cars, we have Soda Blonde, an alt-pop four-piece fronted by lyricist and singer Fair O'Rourke. Today they released their debut album, which is called Small Talk. Next up, another Dublin four-piece, another debut, Inhaler, fronted by Elijah Hewson. Yes, it is that Hewson. And they give us an album called It Won't Be Always Be Like This. And finally, another band fronted by the son of another legendary singer. This time it's Jacob Dylan. Work out the da for yourself. And his band, The Wallflowers, bring us their first album in 10 years. It's called Exit Wounds. Pat Carty, Andrea Cleary have been listening for us. We'll start with Soda Blonde, debut Small Talk. And this is how the album starts. It's a track called Tiny Darkness. Tiny Darkness, opening track on Small Talk, the debut album from Soda Blonde. And as I said, it's Pat Carty and Andrea Cleary who are with us for album reviews on this Friday evening. And let's start with the origins of Soda Blonde, kind of rising out of the ashes of Little Green Cars. Pat, is it Little Green Cars Mark II, or is this a totally different project?
Oh, I think this is a totally different thing. Little Green Cars. I'll use a few road metaphors, seeing as we're talking about cars. So, when they ran out of road in 2019, they didn't hang around the lay-by waiting for the AA. The lead singer, the other lead singer, Stevie Appleby, is off doing his own thing. I think he's involved in the visual arts. But the other members of the band, including Faye O'Rourke, they very quickly got it together. And if you think of maybe Little Green Cars as kind of maybe you could describe them as country rock, this is much more much more a pop kind of thing. And, and to my mind, far superior.
All right.
You know, and that's not to take away from Little Green Cars. You know, they were number one album and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, they had their place for sure. Andrea, the song that we've just heard there, Tiny Darkness, Faye O'Rourke, she really is looking at her place in music, where she fits in and where, to a certain extent, Soda Blonde fits in as well. Does that write across the album, or are there other themes in there as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, that song, that chorus, you could just get so lost in it. And it is this really kind of heart-wrenching moment. It's really brave to kind of open the album with this song. I think there's something about the way she sings, Maybe I Should Have Got a Degree, at the end of the chorus. It just really hits hard, and these levels of harmonies is just so brilliant. Yeah. But she is asking the question of, who is she without music? That song was written as the previous band was kind of winding down. So she's asking, who is she without music? What does it mean to start over? And I think it's a really interesting kind of intersection to find her at. She's kind of looking to the future while also looking at the past, and she's in this. She is to use a road metaphor. She's at a crossroad, and
that's my idea.
I'm happy to run with this for the rest of the conversation if we can.
Would you know the other thing that struck me though? That maybe I was beginning to read things about the band and personal life all in together, but thinking particularly of a song further down the track, listening, I Still Have Feelings for You, which in some ways is like a breakup song, Pat. But it could also be a reference to, you know, previous musical lives as much as anything else.
That's very astute, Sean. That's very
Thank
well
you very
pointed
much.
Out. I would say that, you know, I'm not going to sit here now and try and identify with people in their 20s and all that. I mean, all what you're saying about the lyrics are absolutely true, and they're very much, there is heart in the sleeve element here. But I think what you have here is the real emergence of a real artist here, you know, that these are songs that, and I don't want to take away from the other guys in the band as well, especially say Adam O'Regan. He's got that song you just were playing there. There's a string arrangement on that that's fantastic. Yeah, and the guitars as well. And I mean, one of my favorite moments on the album, I think, is the title track, where it starts off with this analog bass and then halfway through it switches over to the bass guitar from Donal O'Leary, and it's fantastic, you know. And as Andrea says, it's the choruses here, it's the big vocals, Faye O'Rourke is the star here.
All right. Well, you like the title track, Pat? Your wish is my command.
Well, thank you.
So Small Talk, title track from the new album from the debut album from Soda Blonde. And Andrea, Pat, very praising, finding Faye, what's her name, to be Faye, I beg your pardon, O'Rourke. Faye O'Rourke. Finding Faye O'Rourke to be well worth the praise that he's giving her. She has an amazing voice, huge versatility, even in the two tracks we've just heard.
I think as well, I mean, Faye O'Rourke, she is very much kind of the star of this, but I wouldn't say that she's being kind of pushed as the front woman on the record. I think the production also plays a huge part in telling the story of this album. I think when you're listening to her vocals, so much of the kind of the sound and the identity of this album is wrapped up in those harmonies. And when you kind of isolate her voice within those harmonies, she's actually singing in this really kind of vulnerable way, but it's the way that it's layered that makes it kind of belt out of the speaker. And I think that production style, that production, those artistic choices that are being made within the production is what really, really elevates this from just good songwriting to like proper collaboration. Yeah. This is a band who these people have been working together for 15 years, I think. Yeah. Like they know each other, they know what each other like, and this is just it's outstanding. Like it really is.
Outstanding. I'll come back to you for your stars in a minute, but I'll ask Pat for his final roundup and stars. Pat, you enjoyed this, I think.
I did very much. This is what I have written down here. Pop lovers' hearts will swoon to these magical choruses, like the dark trapeze and stuff like that. I would give this a very, very strong 4 out of 5.
It's an excellent album. A very strong 4 out of 5 from Pat. And what are you saying, Andrea?
I'm also a very strong 4 out of 5. I really love it.
Right, very positive, and both in accord on Soda Blonde and their debut album Small Talk. Let us move on then to Inhaler. It won't always be like this, and as I said in my introduction, Elijah Hewson is the front man here. I suppose we have to get the elephant in the room out of the way first, and it must be very annoying for Elijah Hewson, indeed his sister, who's an actress as well, who always the first thing is, well, you know who their dad is and their mom is. Do you think that's been any hindrance or anything? Because they've been around for a while putting tracks out there, Pat. Has it gotten the way up to this? Is it going to get in the way all the time?
Well, I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of people out there because they've spoken to me about it and at length about how, you know, that this band have got it. Have they just got attention because of who Elijah Hewson is, you know? And to be honest with you, when they started out, their first single was a thing called I Want You, which I thought was a terrible yoke altogether. And, you know, they turned up in print and they turned up in the radio. And I did line up with the cynics at that stage to put the boot in and say, "Ah, Jenny, you know, if that was another band, they wouldn't be getting any attention at all." But the thing is, they went away, they worked hard, and they improved as they went along. I mean, I've seen them live a few times, and when I saw them, first of all, they were very average. And then you get to see them, they played at the Electric Picnic there, the last Electric Picnic, and they were excellent. And this album has a lot going for it.
Very good. Let us have a listen to some of it then. This is a track called, well, it's the title track. It won't always be like this.
Well, I want to be the best of what I do.
Be like this, title track from the debut album from Inhaler. Andrea, Pat's saying that, yeah, okay, your dad being Bono might open the door for you, but we were saying here in studio as we were listening to that, it might open the door, but you're going to have to, when you get into the room, you're going to have to earn your place there yourself. Do you think that Inhaler do that on the basis of this album at any rate?
Yeah, I mean, every time I listen to that song, when he delivers the line, "You don't want to be found," I do find myself laughing because it's as if Bono just kind of popped his head around the studio door and decided to sing a line. But no, they have very much steered themselves away from U2. I think they're very much digging through the sounds of kind of early to mid 2000s NME indie, naysayers would call it landfill indie. And I think we'll agree to disagree on that, okay. But they're more than competent, and they've managed to pen a few very decent impressions of that period of time. There's a big influence here. I mean, they've said that they're massive fans of Echo and the Bunnymen. There's influences from bands like Foals, a bit of We Are Scientists, now and then even a hint of the War on Drugs. Who's Your Money On is a tribute to New Order's Blue Monday. They've covered the Stone Roses, the Joy Division. This is kind of like the band, the 1975, they want you to know that they have really good taste in music.
Okay.
So they choose their influences and they just kind of employ them verbatim.
A New Order you mentioned, I think, Andrea, in terms of Who's Your Money On, was it? Yeah.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah.
Well, there you go. I gave Pat a track last time, gave you one this time. Your Money On from Inhaler and the debut album It Won't Always Be Like This. We were saying there as we're listening to that, Pat, it's a big 6 minute song that, you know, and it is crying out to fill a stadium. That's right across the album. But at the very end of that song, there's a kind of a bit of maybe the last 2 minutes, minute and a half, are pretty acoustic, kind of trippy. And they do that on the second last track on the album as well. They go kind of acoustic. I kind of like them to go more that direction. Is that just my taste or did you see something different in that?
I did. I mean, when that breakdown comes in, I thought I could hear a bit of Lizzie's Cowboy Song or something like that. But maybe I'm imagining. I mean, I can hear Talking Heads maybe I imagine that in the guitar as well. I mean, you know, this is a lot better than I thought it was going to be, to be honest with you, because I was in the cynical crowd, and I look like me dad, it's not a crime, you know. I mean, obviously my dad was a very handsome man, as you can imagine, but I mean, you know, I look like him, it's not a crime. You can't get away from that. This is a good record. Is it the best record I've ever heard? No, far from it. It's not even the best of these three records, but, you know,
all right.
I think people should listen without prejudice. How about that?
And how many stars does that mean, Pat?
That means between three and three and a half. 3.25.
I'll allow you to give a half star, no quarter star. Three and a half
no
out
quarter
of five.
Given, no?
No. Three and a half out of five. All I'd say about Handsome, etc., is that we are on radio. And what
face
have
for
you
radio.
Got, Andrea, what have you got to say in terms of stars?
Yeah, I do. I agree. I find it kind of difficult to be cynical about this band because they do seem to be in it for the music, and and that's fine with me. I think that they will go on to improve. They're good enough to kind of let go of having to lean into their influences too heavily. I hope that it, if you'll forgive me, won't always be like this. I'm going to give it a 3 stars.
3 stars from you. And I guess that is it. Yeah, you've been associated with the Houston family might have some positives, but it also means you probably have to work harder to get past the cynicism.
I think so. For a man, right?
Yeah, all right. Let us move on then to our final album, The Wallflowers. You think you have to shake off, to shake off Bono. Try shaking off Dylan, which is what Jacob Dylan, I suppose, has been doing all his life. Prime mover behind the Wallflowers since their inception in 1989. 10 years since their last offering, we have an album called Exit Wounds. Let's have listened to a track called Who's That Walking Around My Garden?
Walk 3 miles of hell.
Who's that man walking around my garden from the Wallflowers? Yeah, I'm a bit unfair of me to play that track first, actually, because it's not representative of the album, Andrea, really, is it? Because the album in general has more of a country feel to it than that song suggests.
Yeah, I think it's mostly sort of leaning into a very kind of roots Americana sort of vibe. That song is a bit of an outlier. It's it's an odd song. I read through the track list at first, and I just remember actually bursting out laughing at just the title of it, Who's That Man Walking Around My Garden? And there's a few kind of moments of like that on the record. I mean, there's a song called The Dive Bar of My Heart, which really made me want to run for the hills. Yeah. And it's weird because The Dive Bar of My Heart actually kind of musically is the song that I like the most on it. So I have a very strange dichotomous relationship with this album where I want to run away from it and also dance to it as well.
I'm with you on the dubious lyrical content. Who's that man walking around my garden? We leave to the one side the extra meaning that might be behind that. But there was another track just a bit up from it. I let you down, but will not give up on you. In other words, I'll be a shocking partner. I'll be hopeless in the relationship, but I'm not letting you go. I'm going to trap you and hold on to you. And Pat, is it only Andrea and
I? Every woman's dream.
Yeah, absolutely. Every man's dream too. Is it only Andrea and I that are hearing these lyrics, Pat?
Well, I tell you, there's a lyric in that where it starts off, I think, who's in charge of this wayward bus? Is everyone falling asleep? Now, the possibility that you might fall asleep listening to this record is very real, if you ask me. I mean, this has everything I'd normally like, you know, and this is the difference, I suppose, between this lot and, say, and a Springsteen or a Tom Petty, who can write these kind of songs and move you in a way. I mean, I thought this was just a bit... It's perfectly fine, you know, but it's a bit generic. I mean, even that song you played there about the garden, which I'm not going to go into the lyrics of that either, but, you know, you might be shooting for the Rolling Stones, but I think you're landing somewhere around Sheryl Crow there, really, and it's just, you know, it's okay. Sheryl. It's all right, you know.
Let's see, I want to give a little bit of the country flavour, though, which is how the album opens, and for the most part, it's the feel you get, I think, across. Now here, if you want to end the relationship, sing that one. Maybe your heart's not in it no more. Out the door immediately with whoever's on the other, on the receiving end of that one. Pat, oh no, sorry, Andrea, I should go back to you. Are you as acerbic as Pat is about this? And give me your stars as you answer that.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get to hear any of Shelby Lynn, comes in for 3 songs in the record. And I think without her input, it would have been an altogether much, much more dreary affair. Mm. But she does lift the songs that she's on. It's perfectly listenable. It has some good moments, but look, it won't be topping any lists, and I don't see myself ever going back to it. I'm going to go 2.5 stars. If Lynn wasn't on it, it would have been 2.
All right. What are you saying, Pat? Just stars,
I'm with Andrea straight away. Yeah, Shelby Lynn saves it if any of it's saved, and I would give it the same. 2.5. It's grand. Yeah.
Total accord across the 3 albums then this evening from Pat Carty and Andrea Cleary. The Wallflowers with Exit Wounds, It Won't Always Be Like This from Inhaler, and Small Talk from Soda Blonde, finishing us off on this Friday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan.